This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 46. Chongqing's Sound of Raindrops, the pointer. With a single stroke, he completes it and passes beyond ordinary and holy. His slightest word can break things up, untying what is bound and releasing what is stuck. As if walking on thin ice or running over a sword blade, he sits within the heaps of sound and form. He walks on top of sound and form. For the moment, I leave aside wondrous functioning in all directions. How is it when he leaves that very instant? To test, I cite this old case. Listen. Chongqing once asked a student, "What sound is that outside the gate?" The student said, "It's the sound of raindrops, master." Ching said, "Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things." The student said, "What about you, teacher?" Ching said, "I almost don't lose myself." The student says, "What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?" Chongqing said, "Though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult." The verse. An empty hall, the sound of raindrops, hard to respond even for an adept. If you say he's ever let the streams enter, as before, you don't yet understand. Understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain, on North Mountain, more and more downpour. This weekend, we had a retreat with Bill Waldron on the Yogacara teachings. Yogacara was one of the very important schools, call it a school, of Buddhism that developed 3rd, 5th century after the Common Era within Buddhism, that along with the Madhyamaka school, both of which are very important in the Mahayana tradition and our own, were very formative or very profoundly influential in both sort of developing, evolving Mahayana teachings and understanding. And the Yogacara, we've studied a couple years ago, we studied Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Understanding Your Mind, which is really about the Yogacara teachings. There aren't a lot of books available on these teachings, and the ones that are out there are pretty difficult. I highly recommend this person's book, and the one that is yet to come out. And they're difficult in a certain sense, one, because they're very scholarly and academic, and they come from a very different time and use language. You know, that like in any field, you have to learn the language of that field. If you're going to study music or engineering or science or whatever it might be, there's language within those fields. And so part of the education is learning the language. And in Buddhism, there's a lot of that. And so encountering the language of the Buddha in the early Pali teachings, encountering the language of Yogacara teachings, of Nagarjuna and the Madhyamaka, within the Zen tradition, becoming familiar with the use of language. And one of the things that Bill talked a little bit about is the sort of inseparable relationship between language and consciousness, between language and everything for us as human beings in the human realm. And I was saying that when we were talking earlier that it's always, you know, I marvel at how, you know, given that as babies we can make all kinds of sounds, you know, and that why in different parts of the world did different groups of people make different sounds, right, and evolve languages that can be so different. And then just the miracle of language to express just with sounds, utterances, that we give meaning to and that can then communicate such profound subtleties. and that can uplift and transform and convey love and bring an intimacy, and can also be used as weapons and be weapons, in fact. And the sort of going out aspect of the language, you know, as we send it out and it has impact, but because we're also listening, it comes back in again. It feeds back in. So we're at the same time, we're speaking out of a conditioned mind, and we're conditioning the mind at the same time. That's why speech, I think the Buddha realizes, such a profound importance in the Buddhist path. What do we say? How do we say it? Where is it coming from? What's its intention? That's a whole nother talk. But the koan is a good example of how language is used, and language in the Zen tradition is used in a very particular way, largely. It tends not to be very didactic. It's often not, or rarely, you know, instructional in terms of this, 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 this. As I said the other day, it's more like a haiku, where it sort of presents from these masters' words their own enlightened view. They're not describing it. They're presenting it. They're giving it to us live. And so it really is mind to mind. Is speaking from an enlightened mind to our enlightened mind. And that's why when we try and listen to it and figure it out and concretize it and so on, it doesn't make sense. It's why there's so many uses of allusion, alluding to something, pointing indirectly, or the use of metaphor, imagery, poetry. All of these different uses of language that are trying to not make things definitive, because we're already doing that. Our mind is already doing that. And so it's challenging. And this is a perfect example. I've always loved this koan because of all that it is. And so in the Yogacara teachings, there's this depth of understanding about the mind that is within our knowing sphere. We see, we hear, we think, we speak, we understand, we come to conclusions, we conjecture. But then it also speaks about the mind beneath that mind. And there is only one mind. But this mind that is spoken of as subliminal or unconscious or subconscious, that we can't touch directly, and yet it is the seat of all of the seeds of our experience, all every perception, experience we've ever had, from which our reactivity, our emotions, everything that we see arising comes from, and that ultimately has to be illuminated, realized. But we can't touch it directly, and so we use the mind, that aspect of mind that we can touch, our senses, our thoughts, our intentions, our words, our embodiment, our physicality, to access, in a sense, that aspect of mind that we'll never touch because it's not a place. So in the pointer, when he talks about sitting within sits within the heaps of sound and form and walks on top of sound and form. So sitting within the heaps is the aggregates, the conditions, as we chanted in the Heart Sutra. Form, sensation, feeling, cognition, perception, mental formations, discrimination, consciousness. In a sense, it's what Buddhism calls you, the person. How with this instrument that we take as one unified thing, that we take as ourselves, that interacts with what we call the world, how does everything come into being? How do we know? And how do we know if what we know is what there is? How do we know if what we see is what is actually in front of us? If what we feel, if what we hear is actually the sound that is being made? If when we see someone and our mind immediately, unasked for, unbidden, apparently without any intentional action, can come to a very full sense of who that person is that we're seeing, even though we've never met them before. How true is that? And this is why, on the path of liberation, because this is the everywhere that we get stuck and bound and are trying to release ourselves from, we have to study really, really carefully what we call the world. And so sitting within the heaps of sound and form, walking on top of sound and form, he's describing how to gain freedom. So it's not about shutting off the senses. That's why it's very important that when we sit, eyes are open, ears are open, right? We're not shutting anything off, because that would not lead us to freedom, right? Because we live in a world in which things flow in and out. But how to do that without getting stuck and caught and bound and deceived? Avalokiteshvara, doing deep prajnaparamita, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions. Freedom within the heaps, the aggregates, the skandhas. To untie what is bound and release what is stuck. Master Hakuin's commenting on this says that he's speaking about dissolving the sticky snares of the emptiness of the ego, what we call the self, and the emptiness of the elements, that we not keep getting caught in these snares, like these traps that seem to have been set everywhere, and we keep tripping them. So first, we have to see them, right? That's the first revolution. We have to stop. We have to start seeing things. We have to see what is actually in front of us and stop turning away from that. And so when we arrive here, hello, nice to meet you. Very nice that you come. Now give us a minute and let us share with you the most important thing that we have to offer. Right? Zazen. How do we begin to see? And then as we engage that, we begin seeing what we have not seen before. We have to begin to reveal what has not been revealed, to illuminate what has been dark. We have to keep coming closer until we can finally see what cannot be seen, know what cannot be known. How is it that this collection of our senses, our mind, our language becomes you, becomes me? What is that alchemy? What are those workings? When we enter, we may not have even thought of the sense of self, that sense of someone who is at the center of every experience, every moment that is experiencing it. Receiving the world coming in, sending the world going out. We just take that, we tend to take that as just what is. That's just me. I have one, you have one. But what we don't see is how the one that I have is actually the center of the universe, right? Because the whole universe is coming in. So I experience it as the center because I'm at the center of that experience. It's all coming into this place, so how can I not be the center of the universe? Unfortunately, you're experiencing the same thing and you think you're the center of the universe. We have a problem, right? There can only be one center. How does that come to be? The eyes see, ears hear. Where's the complication? Where's the bondage? Where's the suffering? Delusion is almost seamless. Almost. Seamless in the sense that, you know, it's like when you're watching a really compelling movie and you forget you're watching a movie, or you're dreaming, a better analogy. You're dreaming. You don't know that you're dreaming, and you're in it. It's all there is. It's happening. It's the real thing. You are flying. You are falling. It's almost seamless, almost because you wake up. Almost because when you're watching the movie, there might be a moment where you realize You remember, you're watching a movie. Delusion is like that. It's almost seamless. It's so compelling. It seems to be such a complete system that we cannot know that we're in it. And in fact, most of the time, don't. And therein lies in so much of the challenge. And to me, it's one of the miracles of human nature and of our sort of inherently, fundamentally, what we might call spiritual nature, the part of us that wants to understand. That within that almost seamless delusion, that deep sleep, deep dreaming, that our eye can open just a little bit. You know, it's like being 1,000 miles beneath the surface of the water, and then there's an instant where you pop your head up for a moment. And you think, what? If it were utterly seamless, we wouldn't be here. Right? It'd be sealed shut. There would be no bodhicitta. There would be no path. The Buddha wouldn't have left home. Shit would just happen. Get over it. Do the best you can. There is nothing else. But we do wake up from the dream. We do have such moments. Something does stir and cause us to wonder, to reflect, to doubt, to seek. So Chang Ching one day calls out and says, what sound is that outside the gate? And that was a question that he seemed to have a fondness for. And the commentary says, you too should understand this right here. When the ancients imparted their teaching with one device, one object, they wanted to guide people. That's the point. This is not entertainment. This is not for any other purpose but to guide people. That's the whole purpose of this. That's the whole of the Eightfold Path. It's the whole of 2,500 years of Buddha Dharma. To guide people into awakening. So one day Chang Ching asked a monk, what is that sand outside the gate? And on another occasion, Chang Ching asked the student the same question. The student said, the sound of quail. Chang Ching said, if you wish to avoid uninterrupted hell, don't slander the truth of the Buddha. What did the monk say? That he answers this way. Another time, Chang Ching said, what is that sound outside the gate? The student says, it's the sound of a snake eating a frog. Chang Ching said, I knew that sentient beings suffer. Here's another suffering sentient beings. Is he talking about the frog or the student? The commentary said, these words are the same as in this case. If you can penetrate here, nothing can block your freedom from within the heaps of sound and form, the skandhas, this body and mind. What is that sound? It's a very simple question. What is that sound? And so the student is answering, it's the sound of raindrops. That's an honest answer. Everybody would answer that way. Almost everyone. Why then does Chang Ching say sentient beings are inverted? What is the student not hearing? In hearing the sound of raindrops, what are we hearing? When he's asked the question, what is the sound outside the gate? The senses are often referred to as gates. We look out through them. The world comes in through them. We stand at the gates waiting and watching, expecting. And we're like sentries, right? Some things we see, you're welcome. Please enter. Other things, no, you're not welcome here. You can't come in. What is that sound outside the gate? Every struggle occurs here. That's what the Buddha realized. There is no suffering apart from this. The eyes don't lie. The object doesn't lie. Even if it's lying, it in and of itself doesn't lie. So where is the deception? Where is the confusion? The whole universe is working together, which is already saying too much, in a state of perfect unity, perfect mutuality, perfect ultimacy. Why is it so difficult for us? Maybe that's why we separate ourselves from everything and think that we're outside of nature, outside of Earth, apart from Earth. And if we're going to be apart, right, we might as well put ourselves at the top and dominate it. Well, that hasn't turned out so well. And so we have this great human consciousness, which is so powerful, so capable of so much. But do we know how to use it? Do we know what it is? So much attention going out to master the universe, and yet, in a sense, we can still be children within ourselves. Not knowing how much power, sort of like I think of teenagers, you know, when you're growing up and your body is like, whoa. And we're coming into all this sort of physicality and emotions and the mind, and it's like, we haven't quite caught up. You know, we're not like ready yet to be quite released. But we're out there, you know. It's sort of like that. It's sort of like as a species. You know, it's sort of like we somebody let us out a little bit too early, right? It's like playing catch up with little time, to do that. Ultimately, what the Buddha realized, what we see is that there is nothing blocking the heaps. That's the deception. That's the illusion. Seeing emptiness of all the five conditions is realizing from the beginning. There is nothing outside the gates. The footnote when the student said, the sound of raindrops, and Chongqing says, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. The footnote says, a concern is born. And in a sense, that's what a teacher is waiting for the concern to be born. In a sense, that's what the path, if the path had a mind, it was waiting, it would be waiting for us to give birth to a concern. What's going on? What is this? Why isn't this working? Chongqing says, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. Hakuin says, in spite of the fact that speech itself and mountains and rivers, earth, cities, bridges, space are all one single, complete, undefiled, boundless, spacious, illuminated Buddha nature. You know, if the Buddha had realized the liberation, which would not have been possible, but let's say he realized the liberation that meant you had to get from here to there, that you didn't have something and you had to get it, or having something you had to take it apart, we could do that. We'd be there. We're all about that. But that would not have been liberation, because the Buddha knew before he realized it that if that were what we called liberation, it would come apart. One day it would deceive us, it would betray us. The only freedom can be from that which is not created, that which is not of your own doing. It's not a result of our cleverness, our brilliance, our... It's just the nature of things. So a concern is born. In another commentary, the teacher said, it's like leading you to the edge of a 10,000-fathom cliff and then giving you a little push, causing your life to be cut off. And here what the teacher means is cut off. The life cut off means that grasping clinging at the sense of me having this life, me not wanting to lose this life, me being this person, me defending myself against you, cutting that off. Teacher goes on to say, if I pushed you over on level ground, you couldn't fall. You wouldn't be able to let go. It's like being in a dream. You want to awaken, but you can't. When someone calls out to you, then you wake up. And so we have to be called. A teacher can do that. Our life coming apart can do that. Being called, then, of course, do we answer? Training is bringing us to that precipice all the time, or more accurately, trying to help us to see we're already there. It's like that well-known poem of Rumi. Stop, listen, you're drunk and at the edge of the cliff. Sentient beings are inverted, we're upside down, or is it the world that's upside down? We lose ourselves and follow after things. And really, we have to become very adept at recognizing that. How do we follow after things? Because we don't see it that way. So much of practice is learning to become adept at recognizing what we have been in the midst of for our whole lives and have just taken as this. It's just what's happening. It's just what's real. It's just what life is. Isn't it the same thing for you? Isn't that all there is? If that were all there is, then why isn't it working better? And so we use, in training, we use working together. We use practices. We use everything. Outside of the monastery, it's the same thing. Use everything. Every moment that arises where you are upset, distraught, joyful, in every reaction that arises, where does that come from? Why does it so easily seem to have a power over us? Why, when we see these cycles over and over and over, and we say, okay, no more. That's the last time. And then there we go again. We see the limits of our will, our willfulness, the force of our mind. It's not enough. Yesterday, Bill mentioned just in passing that something about our time, that this sort of these deep-seated underlying dispositions that are so hard to release ourselves from. They come up again and again and again. It's what leads to so much frustration within practitioners. How many times has every practitioner thought, still? So many times a student will come in and say, I'm still having to deal with this. And I say, just stop saying that. Because that sets up in the mind an expectation, this shouldn't be happening. Something's wrong with me. Something's wrong with the Dharma. Something's wrong. Because this is still happening. I thought that. I thought that in big ways. For long times. And now I realize, at a certain point I realize, I just don't understand. I think I understand, and therefore thinking that, this shouldn't be happening, when really, I didn't understand this. I didn't understand its depth, its subliminal nature. I didn't understand that I was already in the midst of how to reach into that, in a sense, obliquely. That's what practice is. There were a lot of questions yesterday about how do we practice these teachings. We're doing that. That's what this is. We see, we experience things, and from the beginning of our lives, we've been told what those things mean, how to think about them, what to think. Bill told the story of a colleague philosophy teacher, I think, who asks his class regularly, how many of you think for yourselves? Hell yeah. Are you sure? How many of our thoughts are uniquely ours? It's absurd. Right? How could we draw the line? Where would we draw the line? The influences, the constant, ceaseless. And in that, we have our responsibility for this mind, this body, its actions, our intentions. But we have a mutual responsibility because we're all in this. It's a collaborative effort. I mean, it gives a whole, not other, but it really, I think, gives a profound, the most profound spiritual basis for justice. Not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but because it is our nature. There is no sustainable life in delusion. Delusion is inherently unstable. That's why we have to work so hard to keep it going, right? That's why in the beginning of practice, it takes so much effort. The longer we practice, the less effort it takes. And to do this, really to practice, is we perhaps ironically have to actually become very proficient in getting lost, in getting being inverted, in being upside down, in turning away. We have to become very clear about that. You know, we just want to get enlightened. We just want all that to go away. We actually have to become very wise in our delusion. And in that developing wisdom, delusion is no longer what it was. And so we observe the formations appearing, names, beliefs, ideas, judgments, objects, our projections, and the mind is being calmed, not so reactive, not so ready to go to war. Slow it down, be patient, wait and see. Churi, a great master in China, said, stop and see. Stop a while. Being impatient is a dangerous thing in many instances. I mean, in a way, you know, we could say, well, shouldn't we be impatient with climate change, with injustice, and so on? No, we should be urgent. We should have a sense of urgency. There's an imperative. But impatience is just a form of anger. It's a form of aggression. And so in the calming aspects of practice, we're learning how to calm that aggressiveness, that impatience. And in that, we can begin to see things as they are and then respond to them as they are. As things are allowed to rest and dissolve, those sticky snares, now what do you see? What these teachings are showing us is that when something arises, we don't see how that deep aspect of consciousness is clouding what we're seeing. We don't see that happening, so we don't think it's happening. In a sutra, the Buddha once asked the question, when the bell sounds, is struck, does the sound go to your ear or does the ear go to the bell? And we can hear that as a kind of abstract, philosophical question, but it's actually asking about the fundamental nature of experience. Is it out there? Is it in here? What is that sound outside the gate? It's raindrops. Everybody knows that. Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. How do we not get lost? Zazen is the principal path. That's why we should never underestimate it. And in Zazen, of course, what happens is we get lost. now, we get lost. But then we find our way back. Right? Anybody can get lost. That doesn't take any skill. Right? Just wait, get up out of bed. Right? It's already happening. The skill we need to develop is returning, and not getting lost. Examining what we call getting lost and returning, because it's not what we think it is. Like when you're distracted, you're aware in this moment, you're practicing your breath, and then you lose your awareness. Where did it go? What is it? Right? It's like you lost your sock. Right? This thing. It exists somewhere. Right? You lost it. Oh, and then you found it. Right? So it affirms that sense. So when we lose our awareness, it's sort of the same paradigm. But where is the awareness? What is it? What is actually happening? In thinking that we've lost it, we get frustrated when we realize it can't be lost. The frustration doesn't arise. Hakuin said that this is really about not getting excited even when you're at a party. And by excitement, he doesn't mean don't have a nice time. He means getting caught, right, in all what we call the clashes and all of these strong negative emotions that bind us, that invert us, that cause us to lose ourselves. So even in the midst, and it's a good practice. Right? Go stand in the middle of Times Square or in Grand Central at rush hour. Just stand there and let the whole of that universe be experienced in your mind without getting lost. In other words, experience all of that motion without moving. So the student says, "What about you, teacher?" And Changqing says, "I almost don't lose myself." Another translation, actually, Cleary translated this collection and then later translated the same koans with commentaries by Hakuin and also Tenkei Denson and another teacher, I forget who, and translated some of the koans differently. And so the first time he translated this as "I almost don't lose myself," the next time he translated it as "getting to not lose myself." Getting to not lose myself. In the commentary it says, how could Changqing not have known that it was the sound of raindrops? Why was it still worth asking this question? It wasn't for himself. It says, realize that this ancient was using his probing pole and reed shade to examine the depths of this student's mind. The student pressed back, saying, "What about you, teacher?" Then the commentary says, what happened then was that Changqing went into the mud and water to meet him and said, "I almost don't lose myself," getting to not lose myself. The reason for saying this was that the student was losing themselves. Chasing after things was already inverted. So then why did Changqing lose himself too? He says, you must realize that Changqing had a place to get out. To help somebody, we can't be standing on top of a, you know, in a nice safe tower. We have to meet them directly in that very place. I mean, that's the great love of the Bodhisattva. Is that they return to the suffering, not at a distance, they're in it. And they have a way out, or you could say they have a way in, or you could say they're just sitting in it, but not getting excited. Getting to not losing myself. And the student says, what does that mean? Chogching says, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. Another translation that I like says, emerging can be relatively easy. Total expression must be hard. In the beginning, mountains are not our mountains. We see them and they look like just what they are. They appear outside the gate. They're difficult to climb. They get in the way. And so we sit on our cushion, upright, alert, not grasping, not denying. We get off our cushion, we practice the precepts. Not killing, not lying, not speaking of others' errors and faults. We take responsibility. We atone for the harmful things. We repair. We commit again. We get lost. We return. The self arises. Don't become infatuated. Don't be complacent. And as we practice this, the excitement of the party begins to calm. And I remember hearing this in my early years, and I thought, so what is that? Where are we headed? It's like it just becomes like, bah. But then I would encounter the writings and the lives of some of these teachers, and I thought, they're not bah. They're about as alive as anybody I've ever encountered, even at the distance of hundreds of years. Something else is going on. And then as we see through the illusion of these heaps, the aggregates, the sense of self, experience to be attached to things itself is illusion. Mountains are not mountains. The self is empty. Form, sound, color, taste. We realize the nature of things as clouds and smoke, as illusions arising and passing. Something is there, but it's not what it seems to be. And so what do? We sit on our cushion, upright, alert. We realize the body, the mind, the emotions can't be found, unfindable, ungraspable. No owner, no agent, no past, no present, no old age and death. Realizing mind, all is one essence. And then we learn how to walk on thin ice and run on the edge of a blade. In other words, live. We step forward off the top of the 100-foot pole. We are living our lives. Mountains are mountains. It's not what they seem. They're not what they seem, and they're not anything else. Chogching says, though it should be easy to express, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. Emerging, entering into this truth, which is our self-nature, is relatively easy, Cleary says. True, relatively easy. Doesn't mean it's easy, but it's relatively easy. Total expression must be difficult. To live it fully, completely integrated. Not getting lost. I almost don't lose myself. I'm getting to not lose myself. No more chasing. You know, when you get to the point that you realize everywhere you go, you find the thing you're trying to get away from, you can stop. Give it up. Right? This is a good place to start. It's all here. You know, how many of us did we come here thinking, okay, you know, get in, shut the door, lock it, okay, I'm safe. Right? I left it all behind. Whoops. Turn around. Not necessarily so. And that's the good news. It's the good news when we're tired of trying to get away, because we don't have to wait any longer. To realize no one's going to save you is good news when you're no longer wanting to be saved. When we're tired of waiting to be saved. You know, how many times would I sit here on the cushion, deep in my own self-pity, wanting to be saved? But won't the monitors please come over? Won't my teacher please come and save me? They never did. Thank you. An empty hall, the sound of raindrops, hard to respond even for an adept. It's relatively easy to enter. It's much more difficult to step forth without any division. Right? If you say, Changqing has ever let the streams enter, as before, you still don't understand. As long as they can enter, we can get lost. As long as what's arising has the power to anger you, to sadden you, then it has the power. Then it makes sense. Get rid of it. Get away from it. Even though that doesn't work. When we realize it doesn't have the power because it is not it. It isn't what it appears. It isn't entering the streams. We aren't letting the streams enter. There isn't something coming in that shouldn't be here. No hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, no fear means no walls in the mind. Understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain, on North Mountain, more and more downpour. What is that sound outside the gate? Everywhere. Splashing. The footnote says, cut off the two ends. They're not separate. It's not on either side. Where is it? Above your head, under your feet. If you call it the sound of raindrops, you'll be deceived. If you don't call it the sound of raindrops, how can you explain getting wet? Your feet must tread the ground of reality to get here. That's what this is, treading the ground of reality. You know, I was thinking about it. I think I started to say this and then I went off on a different track. When you mentioned that we live in a time that is exacerbating our delusion, right? It is possible. That is true. I completely believe that and agree with that, that it is possible to live within a relationship, within a mind and a body, within a relationship, within an organization, within a nation state, that is more or less deluded and acting more or less out of that delusion. And the more it acts out of that delusion, the more deluding it is, the harder it is to keep from having things turn upside down, to keep from being deceived. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to practice and realize themselves and gain enlightenment before we can start creating a less deluded society. We have lived in less deluded societies. They exist. Everything is on a spectrum. And in a sense, the more when we realize we are in a state of greater delusion within ourselves, it's like when you're driving down the road and you've had too many drinks. And you look behind you and there's a policeman driving. How do you drive? Carefully. Carefully. Because you realize you're on precipitous ground. When we know that we are in a state of heightened delusion, we should be even more careful. Inwardly and outwardly. And so I was thinking of it is the best of times. It is the worst of times. It is the age of wisdom. It is the age of foolishness. It is the epoch of belief. It is the epoch of incredulity. It is the season of light. It is the season of darkness. It is the spring of hope. It is the winter of our despair. We have everything before us. We have nothing before us. We are all going directly to heaven. We are all going direct the other way. The old master says, now, recognizing this, cut off the two ends. They are not separate. It's not on either side. Entering into that is relatively easy. The total expression is difficult. But what else would we do with our lives? You know, practice, in a sense, doesn't begin when we first encounter the Dharma. We've been practicing since the beginning. Thinking, talking, acting, having desires, acting on them, having intentions, following them through. In that sense, we've been practicing something. So now that we know, now how is it? I'll end with Dogen. In stillness, mind and object merge in realization and go beyond enlightenment. Nevertheless, in the state of samadhi, of concentration, of stability, without disturbing its quality or moving a single particle, you engage the vast Buddha activity, the extremely profound and subtle Buddha transformation. Grasses, trees, distant lands are all embraced in this way of transformation together, radiating a great light and endlessly expounding the inconceivable profound Dharma. Without disturbing quality, moving a single particle, not getting excited, we emerge and engaged all Buddha activity. The profound and subtle transformation of grasses and trees and lands all embraced. Poetic way of speaking about what we're in the midst of all the time. And the time that we're in is calling to us. Dada Roshi used to speak of the spiritual imperative. We're in the midst of it. And I think you know, I remember reading when Al Gore first came out with The Inconvenient Truth, and at the very end of that, I believe, he said that the whole crisis that we're in is fundamentally a spiritual crisis. He said no more about that. And I wondered why that was. And I thought, is it because he has a sense of something, but he's not quite sure how or what to say? But I think if we can see that at the core, this has everything to do with how we understand ourselves, that all of the things we see outside of ourselves that are our creation are a mirrored reflection of what is dark within us, that it is a spiritual imperative that we are being called to, which means we have to respond to it with spiritual practice. And so I think when we have the tendency to think of practicing as a kind of luxury, we have to make sure everything else gets done and then see if we have time. That's sort of the mindset of, you know, our culture. And it makes sense, because if you don't take care of certain things, you know, you're going to end up on the street, or you're going to lose your job, or, you know, you're not going to have anything to cook dinner with. And the losses when we don't turn towards that imperative of what is this life are even, in a sense, more dramatic, but more subtle. And so they can be missed. And I think part of that imperative is seeing them, not missing them. And that's what practice does. It helps us to see more and more clearly the urgency. You know, in the beginning of practice, we have to sort of get ourselves to do it. It's a lot coming from the outside. But more and more, it's like, it ceases to be a question. If we care about this life, it has to be this life.
Thanks for listening. Do you have physical challenges to visiting Zen Mountain Monastery or Fire Lotus Temple? The Diamond Net is a group of Mountains and Rivers Order students who are available to support your practice. We provide Dharma and other support to Sangha members facing life challenges such as illness or mobility issues. If you would like to visit the monastery or the Zen Center but need some physical help, someone from the Diamond Net can assist you. For information, email diamondnet@mro.org or visit our webpage at zmm.org and look under the Programs menu.